Well, no doubt you've seen the photo. It's probably the photo that's going to become definitive in the recollection of this sorry saga that we saw over the weekend. That child, I would say 3 or 4 years old, that's just my guess, holding a placard above his head during a protest. That placard screaming, "Behead all those who insult the prophet." And you can see a woman who I presume, I don't know, but I presume was his mother taking a photo on her iPhone, as though this was a happy snap. This is probably the most lasting memory of that protest that went so horribly wrong. And Australian Muslim protesters had gathered to voice their anger over a low-budget US film which was mocking the Prophet Muhammad, and that had caused fury around the entire Muslim world. That fury eventually came to Australia. Most of the protesters, it should be said, expressed their views peacefully. But why did some resort to violence? Was the film to blame? Was it just an excuse? And if so, what was the thing that really provoked the outrage so forcefully on the weekend? How do we understand this? Is it about Sydney as much as it is about Australia, or is it about the Muslim community? Well, joining me now are two people who should know. Rachel Woodlock, who's a researcher and a writer at the Centre for Islam and the Modern World at Monash University, and Associate Professor Muhammad Abdullah, who is the founding director of the Griffith Islamic Research Unit at Griffith University. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks, Waleed.
Thank you, Waleed.
Muhammad Abdullah, I'll start with you. Everyone seems to agree the film's offensive, even those who haven't seen it, which is pretty good effort. Can you really blame, though, a lone filmmaker off somewhere in California making a film that's pretty poor and no one would have paid attention to, if not for protests that simply inflamed the situation?
Yes, thank you, Waleed, and thanks for having me. No, I don't blame the film or the filmmaker. Obviously, the film itself is provocative and insulting to the Prophet Muhammad. But we have to remember that this is not the first time such an initiative, if you like, an insult against the Prophet Muhammad has been initiated. And it's not going to be the last. The attempts to insult the Prophet were, in fact, started during his own time. And it'll be interesting to note how he responded to the insults that were laid and hailed against him. So essentially, my understanding is that people have reacted violently. One, it's an excuse to express their outrage and their anger at, in this case, you know, U.S. policy and foreign policy and whatever. But also, I think it goes deeper than that, and I believe at the very essence is a failure to understand the message of Islam, and also a failure perhaps in the way Islam has been taught, maybe in this context.
Well, you are an imam yourself, as well as being an academic. You've been at that coalface. What are you seeing? Are you seeing a leadership and a religious leadership that ultimately is failing on that score?
The religious leadership, that is the imams, obviously many of them are concerned about what's happening. And just before I came here, the chairperson of the Council of Imams of Queensland expressed his, concerns and expressed his condemnation against the violence. But I would say, yes, the religious leadership needs perhaps to reevaluate the way perhaps Islam has been taught in the mosques and some schools, and really to begin to think of this idea of how we can contextualize Islam in Australia to meet and suit the socio-economic political context, to allow Muslims to work with and not in conflict with the context. Of course, one cannot generalize and blame the entire leadership. But I think there is work to be done. And as you said, as an imam, I see my community. The overwhelming number of people are peaceful and they law-abiding citizens. But all it takes is few individuals to destroy the reputation of entire community.
Rachel Woodlock, I'll bring you in on this because you've done probably more research than anyone else on the social cohesion dimensions of Muslim communities in Australia and comparing different regions. So we'll have that as background and might come to some of your research findings in more detail in just a second. But given that background, how do you read what happened over the weekend?
Oh, I think it's a combination of factors that have all fed into sort of this one crisis point. I think that there is a notion that Muslims have a sort of taboo response, when it comes to derogatory depictions of the Prophet Muhammad. You know, it provokes the same type of taboo response that we might feel on, you know, hearing about, you know, paedophilia or all sorts of things. It kind of, it goes beyond a logical, rational response. It's not to excuse what happened, but just to contribute, to explain a little bit. But also, I think the difference in demographics with Sydney and Melbourne, for a long time in Victoria, there's been sustained community efforts between both the Muslim community and the wider Australian you know, government and community service providers and various organisations to build good relationships. Sydney is a different matter. It's a different kettle of fish. It's not to say that there isn't those activities happening in Sydney. There is. But you also have a, you know, factors to do with marginalisation, high unemployment rates. These types of, when you get young men who are disaffected and alienated from, you know, the potential of inclusion in society, that leaves them open to charismatic preachers who come along and say, look, you know, you don't belong to your parents' culture because you're not from where they're from, and they're not practicing true Islam anyway. This is what the charismatic preachers say. You don't belong to this, you know, this Australian society that doesn't want you anyway, and that's confirmed by the dog whistle politics and the media shock jock attention. And they say, we'll give you an identity, we'll give you a source of meaning in life, come and join our jihad, you know. So where you have this breakdown of inclusion and patterns of cohesion in society, it just means that it gives the oxygen to the more fundamentalist elements of the Islamic world that are a minority voice, and they are there, unfortunately.
But is there, are you suggesting then that this is somehow inherently to do with Sydney? That, well, it's not, these factors are exclusive to Sydney. They're expressed more sharply in Sydney, and for that reason will show up in places like this or the Cronulla riots or something like that?
The research that I've done has looked at a variety of different aspects of Muslim life in Australia. And one of the questions that I looked at was a sense of well-being, psychological well-being amongst Muslims, and how they respond to various questions of how connected they feel to their family, to the community, as well as ideas about how satisfied they are with the government, what do they feel about their future security and their safety. And there are some statistically relevant differences between New South Wales Muslims and Victorian Muslims. Now, the research that looks at well-being says that when you have a breakdown in enough of the various domains of well-being, that's when you can get, not everybody will have this maladapted response, but a certain proportion will turn to things like crime, will turn to, you know, stigmatised identities that will give them a sense of belonging. So that's why it is so important to address, you know, these really long-term issues of social cohesion.
I'm interested in that concept of stigmatised identities, and Muhammad Abdullah, as I mentioned, being an imam, you would have seen this up close. To what extent, I don't know, you can put in percentage terms or give it a star rating or whatever it is you want to do. To what extent is the Australian Muslim identity becoming defined really only by opposition and anger as opposed to something constructive?
I would give it 4 out of 5. Perhaps it's an unfortunate issue, I would say, because whilst the majority of the Australian Muslim community, as I said, are, you know, peace-loving, law-abiding citizens, but the few minority who have reacted violently, and it's not only about these protests, Waleed, we are talking about the concept of radicalization, whether it is through this violent protest or whether what we have seen in the cases of some Muslims in Melbourne, not only in Sydney, that has really stigmatized the community, and the Australian Muslim identity is perceived to be violent, not integrated, and not able to live by the so-called Australian Western values.
But I'm interested in the way that it looks from within the Muslim community. That is, how much of being a real Muslim in Australia is about standing up and shouting loud and loudly and angrily about things you don't like.
Right, yeah. No, I would say from my own experience of the community, it's a very, very small proportion of the community who would feel that. The majority of the Muslim community would feel that being a Muslim is practice Islam within this context and live your life like any other Australian in the street.
Rachel?
Yes, absolutely. And that was the other aspect of my research, is that I found that there was a strong connection with Australian identity for, you know, around about 85% of Muslims. And I was looking particularly at practicing people who self-identify as religious Muslims. Strong connection with Australian identity, strong feelings of affiliation and, you know, contribution to the society, and feeling that their religion actually makes them better citizens. We focus on these small problematic groups because they, you know, can have such serious ramifications. Unfortunately, that often, Professor Abdullah is correct, that often obscures the fact that for the vast majority of Muslims, they are successfully navigating inclusion in Australian society.
It raises, though, that question that it always get asked, and I don't think you can end up having this discussion without someone raising it at some point, and that is, what is it that makes the Muslim community in this context so negatively special? That is, that they respond in a way, even if it's just a fringe, in a way that is far more overblown than any other subculture within Australia, it seems, and not just in Australia, in response to very, very small stimuli.
Well, I think that's because we're in the moment. I think if you look at the history of even things like waves of terrorism and, you know, rising up of violent protests of groups, you know, whether it was anarchism in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, you know, whether it was the various patterns of disaffection on the left, you know, this is something that, you know, radicalisation of young people who feel alienated is not unique to the Muslim community. I think what is quite unique at this particular historical moment is that we have such a global connection through technology and through the internet, that when we see radicalised or we see disaffected young people who are suffering, you know, living in areas where there are dictatorships or there's, you know, there's no social service, social welfare, real breakdown of society, and we see that, we see those images broadcast into our homes through the community, computer, particularly through YouTube, through the internet. It's Professor Riaz Hassan, who's done some research on this, talks about it as being a type of maladapted empathy. And that's a little bit different in this historical moment, that Muslims are connected to communities across the world, you know, in various, you know, parts of the world, many of them that are parts of the developing world that have not the same type of infrastructure, and they don't have the same history of, you know, being part of liberal democracies that we have, and they connect with that and they feel a sort of type of empathy with that, and that's unique, I think, in this particular time.
But Australian Muslims do have an experience of liberal democracy, and many of them, indeed I would venture to say many of those who are in the Sydney CBD have experienced nothing but that. I mean, they're probably born and raised here. So how do you explain that maladaption more locally, Muhammad Abdullah?
Look, I think, as Rachel has mentioned at the outset, there are multiple factors that lead to violent reactions and radicalization, including marginalization, unemployment, and so on and so forth. And whilst these factors in themselves are correct and they contribute to this type of radicalization, however, we must also internalize the problem. We must really look at what is it that these young people are exposed to in terms of the teaching of the faith. One would find, not only in Australia, but also you find young people in Muslim countries who are exposed to a one interpretation of the faith that is often exoteric, that is often legalistic, devoid of any esoteric or any spiritual dimension of the faith, leads to this type of reaction. And hence, we need to address the educational pedagogy, if you like. We need to look at the type of understanding of Islam that imams perhaps are exposing some of these youngsters to.
Well, that's actually an interesting point, actually. Is there something not just that leaves a lot to be desired in the way that imams are teaching, but in what's in their minds in the first place? That is, the content that they have to teach.
Well, and that's correct. I mean, I'm exposed to not only the local context, but the international context. When I go to some of the Muslim countries, I began to see, for instance, post 9/11, a shift to some extent in the discourse of Islam from legalistic to more spiritual esoteric. And however, that is very minimal. We are only beginning to see in the Western nations, the USA, the UK, a revival, if you like, of that spiritual dimension of Islam that anchors a Muslim in certain values, ethics, morality, that allows him to react in a way that is positive and not to be emotionally charged, but rather to be balanced, rational, yet at the same time expressing his or her objections to certain dilemmas without having to become violent.
Well, it's good to know we've got something up on the UK. I mean, I think a lot of the scenes we've seen out of the UK in this regard have been far more distressing than what we've seen even here. But, I mean, if those developments are there and they're positive, Rachel, how much time do we have? How much time before we actually just have to get this right and the situation explodes beyond being retrievable?
I'm a little bit more optimistic about the situation here in Australia. I've travelled a little bit overseas too. And I think that generally we're not doing too badly here. I think I absolutely agree with Professor Abdullah. I think that once, you know, it sounds almost, I suppose, contrary to what you would probably expect, but I think we need more religious education, not less. Hmm. And by that I mean religious literacy, so that our young people, not just Muslims, but so that we become aware and able to critically analyse various patterns of religiosity. I think when we sort of tried to make sure that we didn't sort of have a kind of a favouritism of religion, or we tried to promote secularism, sometimes we've thrown the baby out with the bathwater, and we don't have the type of critical thinking skills to assess how religion is manifested. So we need to, A, have more of religious literacy in our schools, but also for Muslim communities in particular, to expose our young children to the broad range and diversity of Islamic thought and philosophy and mysticism, the sciences that are our heritage, and not just leave it up to the pamphlet Islam that you get coming out of sort of some radicalised groups that are, you know, at times well-funded by oil money. That we need to reclaim that heritage, because once you become aware of the wide range of diversity of Islamic thought, you know, you have to question what you're being, you know, fed to in these pamphlets.
Well, I'm disappointed that we haven't managed to bring world peace in the course of a 20-minute conversation, but I appreciate you both taking the time to speak to us and unveil some of the complexities that are involved. There are obviously a lot more, but alas, that's what we'll have to leave it. Thanks to both of you for your time.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Waleed.
Rachel Woodlock, researcher and writer at the Centre for Islam and the Modern World at Monash University, and Associate Professor Muhammad Abdullah, founding director of the Griffith Islamic Research Unit at Griffith University. I should point out there is a meeting underway in Sydney right now with leaders from community groups, and I assume that that would incorporate very heavily Muslim community groups, on how to respond to the protests. No one is available while this meeting is underway. We've been doing everything we can to get someone from that meeting, but absolutely no way to get them. We aren't sure if they'll speak to the media at the moment. I suspect not. But in any case, if we do manage to crack it, we will finally get through that and bring that to you. Thanks also for all of your texts that are coming in. I'll do my best to get to them in just a moment. But before that, just staying with this story for the moment, we're going to go briefly to Jakarta. There are reports now that protests against that film are getting more heated in Jakarta. We're seeing reports that protesters have thrown petrol bombs at the US Embassy in the capital. And I'm joined now by Tertiani Simanjuntak, who's the city editor of the Jakarta Post, who can bring us up to speed. Tertiani, thank you very much for your time. What can you tell us about the protests outside the embassy?
Well, the clash is still ongoing right now between the protesters and the police. The police are trying to disperse them right now, but they'll remain in front of the embassy. So the police are cordoning off the police are now cordoning off the street heading to the embassy.
Is the situation getting more unstable?
Well, apparently, yes. Actually, the police outnumbered the protesters. Now, only 400 protesters from the previously some 2,000 people stayed in front of the embassy.
Right, okay.
The police already arrested several people suspectedly provoking the situation.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks very much for the update, Tertiani. Good to have the chance to speak to you on the spot. And we'll keep across that. And if there are any major developments while we're on air, we'll bring them to you. Tertiani Simanjuntak, city editor of the Jakarta Post.